Hey everybody, I'm Sex and Love Addict. I'm really grateful to have been asked to speak by Nora, and grateful to be here with you all. I'm going to be recording myself for the LA Intergroup website. If you all in this district or whatever want to send us your speakers, we'll put them on our website, and maybe you're already doing it on yours. But if you want to hear some speakers from LA, slaalosangeles.org/audio has a whole bunch of speakers on it. Let's see. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous since May 8th, 2007. I joined Al-Anon 2 years after that and worked the steps in that program. I joined DA around that time and worked the steps very haphazardly in that program and stopped at four. I'm still in that program, and it has changed my life quite a bit too. When I was about 7 years sober in AA, I joined SLAA, and I've been sober in this program for 8 years. I call my sobriety date August 8th, and it's been a really amazing journey. My life has changed drastically for the better, and it's a wonderful program, this program, and it's not just about sex and love. It's about all sorts of things, all sorts of ways that I interact with the world, all sorts of ways that I exist, and being in this program and working this program has improved so many different areas of this life that I get to live. So I'm just interested in finding out who I'm talking to as well. So here's a fun little exercise. If you have been in this program for less than a year, please raise your hand. Great. And if you are sober less than a year in this program, please raise your hand. Thank you. And if you have more than 5 years of sobriety in this program, please raise your hand. If you have more than 10 years, please raise your hand. Okay, great. Well, it's good to know. That helps inform me. You know, in my original program, or the first one that I went to, AA, there's all these people walking around with 40 years of sobriety and stuff, and I come to SLAA, and it's like I'm the old timer with 8 years of sobriety. I just wonder, when you get the results of the program, maybe it's easy to walk away. You know, I have everything that I want in a romantic life right now. I have everything that I want in a personal life right now. So it'd be really easy to just be like, well, I got it handled. I'm going to take off now. I wonder if that's why or what, but I know I'm sticking around. And you know, part of the reason I know I'm sticking around is because I started in AA, where they teach you work the steps or you die, right? And that's how I approach this program. Because in this program, you work the steps or you die in a lot of cases. I wanted to kill myself many a time because of this program. And I've done a lot of stupid things because of my sex and love addiction, whether it's driving across town in a rage to bang on someone's door, or it's getting arrested for assaulting someone, or it's, wanting to kill myself, you know. So this is a serious program. It's really easy to start sort of loosey-goosey about it. So I was really grateful that I came into this program desperate. For something to change in my life. It felt life or death when I came in, and I'm really grateful for that, because it pressed me to dive into the program and treat it like AA, where people are like, hey, get a sponsor, work the steps, do this, do that, you know. Treating it that way was really helpful. And my first sponsor was very rigid, had very strict bottom lines and strict rules, and I needed that at the time. It was great. And after, I don't know, 4 years or something, I went to a different sponsor that was more like calm and chill and stuff, and that sort of made more sense at the time. Like, my current sponsor is named Jim B. He lives around nearer here than to me, and he's a good guy. Has helped a lot, and he's very relaxed. Woo! I've seen him run some business meetings with people like going like this, and he's just unendingly chill, and that's my goal today, right? I find a sponsor who has what I want, and I do what he did to get what he got. So when I tell my sponsees, okay, you're going to go into withdrawal now, and you're not going to masturbate for a good little while, and they're like, well, you know, what are you talking about? I'm like, do you like, I'm married and I have a baby and I have a beautiful life and I'm happy. Do you want that? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, I didn't masturbate for a few months. If somebody told you, you're gonna start getting $500,000 a year for income if you stop eating pizza for a month, and they're driving whatever, a Bentley or something. This is an imaginary example. The numbers could be very off, but you know, the person says, look, if you want this thing that I got, all you gotta do is not eat pizza for a month. I would not eat pizza for a month. I don't have any problem with pizza, right? I'm not addicted to pizza. I mean, pizza makes me feel very good and I like pizza quite a bit. But if I could see that everybody who just skipped eating pizza for a month suddenly was driving a Bentley, obviously I want a Bentley, I don't know if you can tell, I'd stop eating pizza for a month, you know? But the funny thing is that when we pose that question to you in this program, we get all these quibbles about it. Anything that I don't want to stop doing for a month, I'm probably addicted to it, you know? I probably have some kind of strange relationship to it. I might be making it my higher power. I might be making it my source of self-worth. And, hopefully I don't have that relationship with pizza. So, I'm 40 years old, and I got sober in AA at 24. And so I guess I got sober in this program at 32, something like that. And my whole life, I really wanted people to like me. I was really concerned about what people thought of me. I lived and died by people's opinions of me. And that was hard. It was really hard. And I twisted myself into a pretzel to make other people like me. I did everything I thought other people wanted me to do. And by the time I made it to this program, my whole life was based in making other people like me. Now, I fully support all creative endeavors by everybody. And my story is one of stopping doing creative endeavors. But I think everybody should do whatever the hell they want. But for me, what I discovered is the reason that I was an actor was because I wanted people to like me. I wanted every single person in the world to know my name. And as a sex and love addict, I want every person to want to sleep with me. And I want every person to want to be my friend. And I'm not satisfied until that's true, and then when it is true, I'm still not satisfied. I want more. Maybe I want animals to be in love with me too. I don't know. But nothing is enough. My understanding of the disease of addiction is that I have a physical allergy, a mental obsession, and a spiritual malady. The mental obsession, I'm sure we are all familiar with. If you're obsessing about that person, you're obsessing about that thing, if I get into my head, I'm going to do this thing today, I'm probably going to do that thing. I think all addicts are really familiar with what the mental obsession is. And I've got a physical allergy. In AA, they say if I have a shot of alcohol, then I need to drink all the alcohol. If I have a little bit, then I want everything. The physical allergy is triggered in SLAA by the dopamine that gets released in the brain. I'm not a scientist, but when a person compliments me, the same thing that happens from doing heroin happens in my brain. Like, I'm just like, oh yeah. The moment my wife tells me I'm smart, I say, well, tell me how I'm smart. What did that smartness look like to you right then? Was that more smart than the other day, or? I can't get enough compliments. So I have a physical allergy, you know, and it's interesting in AA, they say because we have a physical allergy, we just got to stop altogether and never do that. But in SLAA, we're not going to just stop altogether, right? I can't not be around people. I can't not have a relationship. But what I can do is stop for a while, which is the withdrawal period, and let God into my relationship with all of these things. I can take all of these things, dating, relationship with myself, masturbation, all of these things, I can put them aside and just develop a relationship with myself and learn who I am and let God take care of these tools. And maybe, just maybe, when I get them back, I'll have a different relationship with them. So anyway, I have a physical allergy that's triggered by this dopamine that's released when somebody looks at me, right? Somebody just looks at me. If they look even the remotely interested, and all of a sudden I'm filled with drugs. If anyone's ever tried to stay away from a certain ex for a long time, and then you see them on the other side of the room at a meeting or a whatever, and you might identify with this feeling of my body is just filled with drugs the moment I see them. You know, it's an actual physical withdrawal and then a reintroduction of some kind of drug. So there's physical allergy, mental obsession, and then the spiritual malady. And so my understanding of the addiction is that the spiritual malady is that I am never happy with what I have. I'm never happy with where I am nor when I am. I want it to be last year. I want it to be 2 years from now. I don't want to be here. I want to be at home, like eating a pizza with my wife on a Saturday night. If I were there, I'd be like, why didn't anybody ask me to speak recently? You know, when I'm home on a Saturday night and I'm like, I'm just so tired, all I want to do is relax, the brain is going, you should be at a party. All the cool people are at parties. If I'm at a party, I'm like, man, God, this sucks. I just want to be home. Ugh, this is all these people. Ugh. I'm never happy with where and when I am. And so I have this gaping hole that needs to be filled in order to feel comfortable and complete. And so I just start stuffing things in my hole. And you can laugh at that, it's okay. So, you know, I learned that, you know, for me, all of these addictions are connected. For me, I can try to drink to fill this thing. I can eat cookies. You know, I used to buy a bag of chocolate chip cookies at Trader Joe's and eat the whole thing all the way. Like, I buy all my groceries and some cookies. I'd eat the whole bag of cookies on the way home and put the rest of the groceries away and throw away the cookie bag because the cookies made me feel good, you know? And nothing makes me feel good when I'm not spiritually fit. Nothing is enough. So I need so-and-so to just text me back. If this person were just my significant other or my spouse, if this person would just sleep with me, then I'd be cool. If I could just have sex with enough women, I and other people would think I were a man. Finally, I could be a man if I just had enough sex. And no matter how much sex I have, still don't think I'm a man. I still don't have any self-esteem. I still have something to prove. I still have to prove that I'm the smartest, funniest person in the room every single time I open my mouth. And then I'm trying too hard. I'm pushing people away with my desperate behavior because I can't get enough to feel okay. So I have this spiritual malady. So I know that I have this disease. It's a threefold disease. Now I gotta treat it. And thankfully, we have ways of treating this. All these books and programs, they tell us how to treat it with that triangle. You know, the triangle and the circle. Unity, service, and recovery. Unity is coming here and telling you what's going on with me and opening my heart to you and sharing. Tradition one says personal recovery depends on unity. So if I want to stay sober, I have to participate. I have to raise my hand and share. I have to accept when somebody asks me to speak. I have to tell you how I'm feeling. If I don't do that, I'm not going to stay sober, right? So I need to do unity. Then I need to do recovery. That means for me working the steps with my sponsor. I need to stay working the steps with my sponsor. When I finish those steps, I need to do some other steps or some other thing. I believe that step 11, I've always believed that step 11 tells me that I need to keep doing stuff. It says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, to improve our conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. So if I'm continually seeking to improve my relationship with a power greater than myself, then I'm going to be trying to open up the spiritual passage. I'm not going to work the steps and then stop. I'm going to keep going. And I need that. I need to continue treating my addiction because my addiction is getting stronger while I'm treating it. Why do so many people like happily go through steps 1, 2, and 3 and then they get to step 4 and then they stop? And they're like, why do I have to write in this notebook by myself? I don't want to do this. This is becoming overwhelming. Screw it. Why does everybody stop at step 4? Why do they quit? Because you've been treating the disease before that. You've been treating the disease, and the disease doesn't like being treated. You know, if I have diabetes, my diabetes is not like, hey, don't give me insulin. Stop. No insulin for you. If I have cancer, my cancer is not like, hey, man, you don't need that chemo. But addiction tries to talk you out of treating it. So you get to step 4, and your sponsor's like, hey, here's your notebook. Go write. Go do the work. And your addiction starts going, man, I don't need this. Why do I need to write in this notebook? This is bullshit. Why don't I just text so-and-so? Life was so good with so-and-so. And all of a sudden, you're out. You're done, right? The addiction doesn't like getting treated. The better my life gets, the worse my addiction hates it. The more I try to mess it up, you know? I'll start an argument with my wife over nothing. Because I don't believe I deserve to have a wife. I don't believe that I deserve to be loved. My addiction doesn't believe that I deserve good things. So the better my life gets, the more my addiction tries to mess that up. And so how do I stop that from happening? By treating it harder, by doing even more, right? When my first year of recovery in AA, I did all the stuff that newcomers do. I got to a year, and then I was kind of like, okay, what are all the big boys doing? Well, they're somebody's got a H&I commitment. The adults doing. What are the genderless description of a grown person people doing? They're taking H&I commitments. They're going to speak at a meeting. They're raising their hand to sponsor people. What can I do to get into this program deeper? What can I do to treat this thing more? Why do I want to treat this thing more? Because it works. If it started working, it's going to keep working, and it's going to work better. It's going to keep working better and better. This thing works, so whenever I look at a thing that I'm addicted to, it looks like a ticket back to the bullshit that was before. What is, for me, the BS that was before in SLAA? I was telling you a little bit about how I molded my life to be everything that I thought other people wanted me to be. And I was telling you, I'm not against any creative pursuits, but for me, I was like, I need everyone to like me. So all of my work is going to be on being a famous actor. Except I also, I started a grunge band, started touring everywhere. I wrote movie scripts, went to Sundance and bugged everyone all day. Read my script, read my script, read my script. And that's okay. I'm not saying anything bad about trying to sell your script. That's a great thing. Promoting yourself, standing up for yourself is great. But my whole life was based around like Somebody please recognize me. Somebody please tell me I'm enough. I've got a script. I've got a radio show. I'm bringing people on the radio show. I'm doing a music radio show at night. Like, listen to my music choices are so good. I'm writing a script. I cannot imagine how much energy I put in my 20s. There was some point with my band where I was just like, I am bugging everyone I know every month to drag themselves across town to this club that I'm gonna drag all of this heavy equipment into all by myself and make like $40 or something. And I know people at multiple levels of success higher than the band I'm in that are still not making enough money to live off of. And this is what I'm doing all the time. There was a turning point in my life with my social life, like in my late 20s, all I wanted to do was be the coolest Silver Lake hipster in the world. I hung out with all of the coolest Silver Lake hipsters who threw the coolest parties, and none of them knew me. I didn't know them. We all were like, hey, hi, hey, we're all at the coolest party. We had like no actual connection. And I was at this New Year's party. You know, it's a 45-minute share, so I can tell a short anecdote, maybe. I was at this party, and there was a kissing tent at this party, and people were on E and rolling and stuff, and I'm sober. There was a kissing tent, so I went in the tent, and I was like, someone's going to kiss me because I'm in this tent. And and I was, like, wearing a suit, and people were like, had cigarette ash, and I'm like, I don't want to get it on my suit. You know, you can see I'm wearing a mask. I'm very OCD. So this pretty lady was like, I will give you, if you let me wear your glasses, I will give you the kiss of your life. And I said, oh, okay. So she took my glasses, and then she licked up the middle of my face and then bit my nose.
Ew!
And I was like, what the hell am I doing? Why is this my life? These are not my people, you know? So the following New Year's, I went alone on a vacation to Mexico City, which should have been the perfect healthy choice, right? I'm getting, but this was before SLAA. So it should have been like, I'm going to Mexico City, I'm going to have New Year's with myself, I'm going to meditate on this pyramid. It should have been like a really healthy thing. But I started getting on whatever dating apps to find people to go to attractions with me. I met a woman at a bar, and then I decided I was in love with her. And then we went to everything together, and we were in love, and she was going to move to America and marry me, and, you know, none of that happened. But this is, you know, bringing my sex and love addiction to all corners of the globe. It's a person who's, like, a person who's recognizing that everything in my life is empty, but and I'm trying to get with myself, but I don't know how to do that, and I my addiction's leading me anywhere, everywhere. So I had this band, and in the band, I wrote all the songs and everything, but I'd always have a really pretty lady singer in the band because I don't have any self-esteem, and I think everyone wants to look at the lady and not me. So I'd write parts for both of us to sing, and she'd be up front, and we'd have the lady singer. And, you know, if I'm not too long-winded and it fits in, I'll talk about anorexia in this program as well, being afraid to be seen, because, you know, you would think I'm a talker. I would, you know, go around and talk to all these people. I put myself in all these performance situations. You would think that guy's not anorexic. He loves being seen. But the thing is that I would always make jokes instead of telling the truth. And if I'm the performer, then I'm the center of attention, but I'm also separate from everyone, and no one actually needs to know me. So my anorexia, my belief that I'm not good enough or not worthy of being known or actually having real connections with people, I could seem like I was really outgoing while at the same time not letting anyone know me, you know, having complete walls up. So Getting back to the train of thought. So I had this band, and there was a woman I was dating, and she auditioned for the band, and my AA sponsor was like, don't date this woman. And I was like, I'm gonna date her. And so we were dating, and it was horrible. And of course she was in the band, and so there's like back and forth, breaking up. We broke up 14 times in 10 months. We put out an album called Back and Forth Forever. That had, it has a picture of the two of our faces yelling at each other on the cover. It was torture. And I just wanted to, I wanted to kill myself all the time. It was horrible. Towards the end, I think after we were broken up, we were still playing together, and she had some new guy she was dating come to the show, and he's like standing in the front. It was overwhelmingly painful, so I wrote a song called Boyfriend. None of these things were actual hits. Like, you're not listening to some kind of secret music star speaking. Like, I'm a just some dude who had a band. And it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. And we went on tour, and the tour fell apart. Like, the last tour we did fell apart because of all of the shit. Like, she and I had all this tension, and the other band members were so sick of it, and people were just like, I'm just gonna rent a car and drive home. I'm out of here. So I ended up in this place where I just wanted to kill myself over this person that I had to see all the time, and I couldn't stay away from her. And I went to the most sagacious AA people, like old men that know everything, you know, the guy who everyone goes to at the huge meeting, that's like, that guy, he knows, he's sober AF. I went to that guy, I did something like a relationship inventory with him. I did stuff with the Al-Anon people, relationship inventories and everything, and nothing helped. I just kept going back to this person who would take me back and then dump me, and then take me back and then dump me. And I wanted to die. So I came to this program desperate, desperate as a drowning man who wants to seek a life preserver. Life preserver. Yeah. I like the, you know, the logo is a life preserver. I was down for whatever would make me not feel horrible all the time. And I was looking for a sponsor, and I found this guy who is very eloquent, very well-spoken, a great storyteller, a great explainer, really sober, really smart. And I asked him to sponsor me. And I haven't broken my bottom lines since the day we set those bottom lines. And I never, you know, went back to that person again. I have a foggy memory of maybe we did like 30 days no contact, and then I was supposed to call her and then discuss it with him or something. But I never went back to her. And it was such a relief. You know, withdrawal was such a relief. We set some arbitrary seeming bottom lines for this early period of withdrawal. I'm a big proponent of withdrawal. There's a chapter about it in our book. And it says you will be on the floor of your bathroom crying, or you could be, when you go through withdrawal. It says it's tough. I've never heard anyone having an easy time quitting heroin. You know, people are puking all over the place and falling over and all of this stuff. So why should our withdrawal be any different? Why should our withdrawal be easy peasy? It's just as life and death. Do you know anybody that's killed themselves because of this program or died because of this addiction? Not because of this program, but because of the addiction. I actually liked withdrawal because it was very black and white, and I knew what I could do and I couldn't do. And I'm a bit OCD, and it's really nice to have all the gray area removed. So, you know, I would torture myself quite a bit, like, should I have gotten that woman's number? At a coffee shop, some person smiles at me, and then I'm like, oh, I should have gone back and asked for her number. Oh, no, what did I do? And all day long, I'd be thinking about it. Did I miss the love of my life because I didn't ask the woman who smiled at me for her number? Or I'd ask somebody for her number, and it would be the wrong situation. You know, like a retail clerk would be ringing up my clothes and saying, like, how are you today? And I'd be like, oh, will you go to dinner with me? Someone likes me? What? So I would torture myself all day about the whether it was right or wrong. So what was really great about withdrawal is that I couldn't ask anybody for their numbers. There was a short period of time where I couldn't be in the same room as a same enclosed space alone with a woman. There was also a period of time where I couldn't initiate a conversation with a woman. Like, I couldn't be like, hi, how are you? You know, I couldn't initiate a conversation with a woman. I remember at one point I was going to do my laundry in my building, and this woman got in the elevator with me on the way to go do the laundry. And every other time I would be like, hey, what's up? Hi, you know, and I got in the elevator with this woman. I'm like, I'm not allowed to say anything to a woman. Okay, just gonna stand here with my laundry. How do I look in my pajamas and stuff? I'm just standing here. And that woman didn't say anything to me the whole time. And the elevator went down, and we both went into the laundry room, and she said nothing to me the whole time we were both in the laundry room. And I was just like, do people do this? Where they're in the same space and they don't say anything to each other? It blew my mind that somebody could have no interest in me whatsoever and be thinking about their day, and that could have nothing to do with me. It's not personal that the person's not interested in talking to me. They're thinking about other stuff. You know, I'm not the center of the universe. You know, me speaking today is not about me, right? If I speak in a way that helps treat your disease, then I did what I'm here to do. But it's not about me. It's not about you guys thinking I'm the soberest dude around, or the fucking guy on the mountaintop with the sobriety. I learned when I took step 3 out of the AA big book, I took it out of this book as well. I love this book. That God is my employer. And it's just so freeing. You know, we have these jobs. It's like, what does my boss think of me? Is my boss happy? What do the people at my work think? Am I making the quota this week? Am I doing that? It's so freeing to know that God is my employer, and my primary purpose is to be of maximum service to God and to my fellows. So I'm doing my job tonight, right? I'm trying to be here and be of service to you. That is, that's my job. That's my only job. And my addiction and my ego want to struggle with that all the time. But my job is to help you. And God, what a relief. What a relief it is to stop trying to prove and win and get. There's nothing to prove. There's nothing to win. There's nothing to get. I get to just exist. Life is just going to happen, and I'm just going to watch it happen. And I don't need to prove anything. God, what a relief. What a relief. I can be a terrible speaker, and it doesn't matter. It's okay. I don't need to prove anything to anybody. What a relief. This addiction is an addiction to proving. My addiction is to all of you thinking that I'm the fucking best speaker ever. Like, that's my addiction. And you know, I'm at 34 minutes right now. At some point, it'll hit 45. And as soon as 45 hits, I'll think, I should have said this, and I should have said that. You had 45 minutes to talk, and you still forgot to say this, and you still forgot to say that. That's the addiction talking, you know? We get to just exist in the present moment. We get to show up and do what we're supposed to do and stay out of the results. Just do what we're supposed to do and see what happens, you know? The rest is in God's hands. And when I say God, I'm not talking about the Christian God, although there's nothing wrong with any of the different gods. It's my understanding of God. My understanding of God is that this is just mine. My understanding of God is this infinite entity that is everywhere, all at once. It's everywhere, everything, all at once. God is everything and everywhere and all of us, and it's infinite. And I have a finite mind. I can understand finite things. I can't understand infinite things. Thank you. So I gave up trying to understand an infinite thing. I don't understand God. All I know is that when I ask God for help, God helps me. That's all I need to know. I ask God to keep me sober. God helps me keep me sober. You know, I pray every morning, God, please help me to stop deriving my self-worth from the opinions of those that do like me, those that I want to have like me, those that don't like me, those that I don't like, those that I do like. It's like fucking everybody, you know, everybody's opinions. You know, God, please help me to stop deriving my self-worth from my career, from my love life, from how much money I have, from the person who's sitting or standing next to me. You know, my dating life forever was dating people who I thought you would think I was cool to be dating. I remember there was a woman who I was dating who was a model, and she had some kind of news show too, I don't know, but she was a model and she looked like a model, and I would go to fancy events with her and people would take pictures of us and I'd be there with this fancy model lady. And she looked like she would be the sister of my nerd nemesis in middle school. Every time I looked at her, she reminded me of this kid that he and I hated each other in middle school. She looked like she was related to him. But everybody else who saw me with her, I thought, would think, you know, I'm very successful, I'm very cool because I'm with this woman. And I dated her for weeks or a couple months or whatever, and I bought her all sorts of stuff and spent all this money, and it finally got around to her being like, tonight is, however a person says this, tonight you can have sex with me, whatever that means. So it came to sex time, and finally came to sex time after buying all this stuff and all, and my equipment didn't function. And I was like, I don't know why this is happening. I don't know why none of this is happening. The reason it was happening was because I didn't like her. I didn't care about her. I wasn't attracted to her. She reminded me of this guy that I hated in middle school. But I was dating her because I wanted everybody else to like me, you know? I had a band because I love singing. I love making up songs. I think I'm a great writer of lyrics. But I had a band because I wanted people to think I'm awesome. I booked some great acting jobs in my 20s. I have a pretty good resume, right? It's probably like, you know, outside of LA, nobody has that resume at all. That's great. But that doesn't make me a better person because I booked XYZ. I remember somewhere around my 30th or 33rd birthday or something, I hadn't booked any acting jobs in 3 or 4 years, and I booked Veep. And I was just like crying, like finally, you know, I booked something. And then I didn't book anything for 3 or 4 years after that. So it was like 7 or 8 years that I only booked one job right in the middle of it. So it sounds fancy to talk about it, but really I was making my whole life about getting this thing. I got one thing in 7 years. So I got to let go of those things in this program. And when I want to be funny, I'm funny for my family and my wife and my daughter. And maybe when I'm delivering the message to you, if I'm funny, it helps the message be slightly more listenable. I get to be a human being who's funny. You know, people said I was funny, so I tried to do stand-up comedy. None of my jokes were funny. I wrote all these jokes. They weren't funny. They were terrible. But I needed to put myself in front of other people. You know, I never expected that I would end up with the life I have, which, like, right now, the projects that I'm most excited about have to do with Seinfeld and Dungeons and Dragons. That's and I'm playing a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. Don't bring me to the fantasy addiction meeting, but I love me some D&D. So I'm gonna get it. I got like 5 minutes left, so you know, I got through withdrawal, and then and withdrawal ended after I finished the fourth step, and the fourth and fifth step, reading my fourth and fifth step to my sponsor. And then I was allowed to date again. And all of a sudden, I was afraid to date. What happened was I was showing up as my authentic self on a date for the very first time. You know, the really cool thing about withdrawal is that I take away everything that gives me a hit. Every single thing that is artificially soothing to me, and I'm left alone in reality. And reality is unbearable. To an addict, reality is unbearable. So I'm left in a painful place when I'm in withdrawal where I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to develop a new relationship with myself and with God, or I'm going to go crazy and leave the program or, you know, hurt myself or whatever. I'm going to go crazy. Withdrawal is where I'm left alone so I can build a relationship with myself. And I realized that all of these music shows I was booking, that I felt completely alone. I was throwing like 8 music shows a month as this party promoter in Silver Lake, putting on all these hip, fancy bands. People, I wanted to be the guy. I was the guy who was like, hey, can I have a show? You can help me get a show. People want to talk to me because I'm going to get them a show. Then I'd go to the show and I would feel completely alone and bored and not interested in what I was doing. I was doing it because I wanted people to like me. What I actually liked doing, what I discovered I actually liked doing, was playing Magic the Gathering on Friday nights at a comic book shop with a bunch of nerds, because I'm a nerd and I like that. And so there was this slow transition from this whole life that was about what people wanted me to do to a life, you know, I started playing Magic the Gathering, and I know I like board games, so there was this person, I went to her house and she had groups of people playing board games. I started making friends at the board game night, and then this person has a board game night, I'm going to go play board games with them. All of a sudden I have a hobby that is authentic to me. You know, maybe for you it is going to those music shows. It wasn't authentic for me. I was doing that because that's what the cool kids did, and I wanted to be cool to everyone. For me, what I actually liked doing was this other stuff I'm talking about. And I started to develop a relationship with myself when I hit the pause button on the whirlwind of please like me, the constant cyclone, when I just sat still and said, look, man, you gotta know yourself and you gotta get your comfort from God. But I'm telling you, if you're newer, give yourself a hug and a pat on the shoulder. It'll probably make you cry. If I give myself a little kiss on the shoulder, I say, hey, I love you, man, to myself. If you try that when you're alone, it might make you cry if you're anything like me. It sure as fuck is comforting, and it's a great thing to practice. Practice. You know, I will insult myself in front of other people all the time. We're playing a board game, and I make a mistake, and I'll say, guys, I'm sorry, I'm so dumb. I started contradicting those thoughts and those words out loud. So every time, I got 2.5 minutes. So every time I'd say something like that, I'll say right afterwards, I'll say, I'm a good person and I'm worthy of love. And I'm glad I'm here doing this, you know? I'm a good person and I'm worthy of love. I'm not stupid, you know? What I discovered about addiction is I go to the freezer in the middle of the night and start eating peanut butter cups that I bought at Trader Joe's. And I'll just eat them, and then my brain will go, you fucking piece of shit eating this shit in the middle of the night. Look what you're doing to yourself, God damn it. And the more I hear that in my head, the more I want to eat more of the peanut butter cups. And what I started doing is I'd eat one or two peanut butter cups and I'd hear this voice in my head, and then I'd say out loud, I'm worthy of love. I deserve a nice little snack in the middle of the night. I say it, I'm like, I'm a good person and I deserve a little snack. And I'd have a couple cups. And lo and behold, when I say that, I don't want any more cups. I only want a couple. Because our addiction is based in shame. Our addiction is based in shame. It wants us to feel ashamed of ourselves so that we go to the source of the addiction again, more. More we hate ourselves, more we dive into our addiction more. Our addiction is based in shame. So if you can remove that shame, if you can counteract that shame, if you can pray to God to remove that shame, I'm going to go like 45 seconds over. If you can pray God to remove that shame, the addiction loses its power on you. So a year ago, I got married, and the reception at the wedding had my Magic the Gathering friends, my board game friends, my friends from that were still around from music promotion. They were all there. My clients from my business were there. People that loved me were there. And it was all those people for me with relationships that I built as an authentic person. I have a relationship that I built with a woman who got to get to know the person that I am, because I knew who I was. And I said, here, this is me. And then I got to know who she was. And we get to have an authentic, actual, healthy relationship. And our baby daughter, Siobhan, was born August 31st of last year. And she's coming up on 8 months. And I think she just said, I love Dada the other day. I don't know, it's debatable. And tomorrow is my wife and I's wedding anniversary, 1 year wedding anniversary. And we're gonna go to the LA Arboretum, which is where we had our first date that I said, I love you on that day, is where we got married at the Arboretum. And we're gonna go walk around there with our baby for our 1 year anniversary. So if you ask me why I say you got to work this program more and make sure the addiction doesn't take over, it's because I have a beautiful, unbelievable gift of a life today because of this program. So I'm not going to do less. I'm going to do more if I can. Thanks for letting me share.